Resuming this afternoon, we have a great program for you. Jeffrey Barnett and Carol St. Clair will be talking to you about some of the ethical and legal issues related to providing online mental health services. They are clearly two experts in the area from US and Canada, so they will each of them will be speaking for 25 minutes. And we'll have a 10-minute question period afterward. I want to apologize for those who went to workshop C this morning. It wasn't indicated that the session was in French. I apologize for that. Most sessions are actually in English. That one escaped us and should have been here in this room because it has translation. But I don't expect this to occur again, so don't worry. So I will now leave the podium to Jeffrey Barnett from the U.S. and representing the APA. And the title of his talk is "The Provision of Online Mental Health Services: Ethical and Legal Issues and Recommendations for Practice." Dr. Barnett.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here speaking to you this morning. And unfortunately, I get you immediately after lunch at your highest level of interest and being fully awake. So that's wonderful. But the food was wonderful. I just want to point out that while I am the current chair of the American Psychological Association's Ethics Committee, I'm actually not speaking on behalf of APA or its Ethics Committee. I'm just here presenting on my own. But clearly that's one of my roles in which I have experience with addressing ethics and legal issues for psychologists. In terms of disclosures, I don't have anything to disclose. I don't have the unfortunate or unenviable position of saying that I actually receive $17 million per month from a pharmaceutical company, unfortunately. If I could disclose that, though, I would. I'd be happy to share that with you. Clearly, as we've already been hearing today, the internet and mental health services have been going hand in hand together for quite some time. And there are a number of reasons why the use of the internet can be extremely helpful for providing mental health services. And, you know, and I speak generically, so it could be psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, nurses, physicians, healthcare professionals of a variety of sorts. I don't limit my remarks just to any one profession. But clearly there are many individuals who might not have access to care. So in terms of people in rural and remote areas, there are numerous regions where appropriate health care might not be available, and the use of the internet might be able to grant access for these individuals. Some people are homebound. It could be a transportation issue, a person who doesn't have the physical transportation available to them, or they could have a mental health problem or physical problem that prohibits them from going to access the care. So certainly someone with agoraphobia might be a good example, someone who would not leave their home to go see a mental health professional for treatment of their difficulty leaving their home. You can see the conflict there. Or someone who's disabled. There can be numerous other reasons why someone might not want to go seek the treatment themselves personally. Certainly stigma associated with mental health problems can be a factor as well, and the ability to access it online might make it more conducive. We heard earlier this morning that, you know, the use of anonymity, not being there in person, might open things up and people are freer to share information, feel more comfortable. The internet can also be useful for in-person mental health services. So if someone's receiving in-person or in-office psychotherapy, for contacts between those sessions. And that's an area that is not fully tapped into yet. There are numerous opportunities there. A client can be given a homework assignment by their mental health professional, and there could be active daily follow-up on how they're progressing, or actually share the data. So if someone has, for example, a dysfunctional thought record that they're keeping to address their depression, and they can actually send those responses in electronically to their mental health professional on a daily basis and receive feedback, rather than wait a week or however long it might be till their next appointment. It's also a significant cost savings. There's a lot of data that shows that you can save a significant amount of money in terms of how much health care actually costs for the consumer as well as for the employers or those who pay for services, and that can make it certainly desirable as well. In terms of technology and practice, I look at technology very broadly. And you know, originally, the telephone was viewed as a form of telehealth and as a way of having contact with clients in between sessions. Certainly, if I've had a client I've worked with who then maybe is on vacation for the summer, and does that mean this person has to discontinue their services, or do they have to seek services from someone else just for that six-week period of time, or can we continue and have online or in this case telephone sessions? And so that might be a very basic use of technology. Certainly if people have crises in between appointments, the use of the telephone is widely used. And that's certainly evolved into the use of cell phones, which provides greater access. And a fax is a form of technology. It's not really used for provision of clinical services, but certainly for written materials. All this has evolved into the use of the internet now. Many clients will use email as a way of communicating with their mental health professional, text messaging, and it's evolved to IATV, interactive televideo communications, things like Skype, or where you can actually see the person. And because with email therapy or e-therapy, there's an absence of the actual physical cues, tone of voice, facial expressions and gestures, things like that. It's not to say that that's not necessarily valuable. Some very good services can be provided through email or texting. But when you have the visual cues and can actually hear the person real time, it certainly enhances the quality of the service. This is just a very brief early definition of telehealth, which again addressed all forms of technology. And so it's any telecommunications and information technology to provide health assessment, intervention, consultation, supervision, education, and information across distance. And so again, it highlights it's not just providing psychotherapy or counseling over the net. It could be supervision provided across a distance because there's a lack of appropriate trained supervisors in the local area. Online mental health assessment, we saw some examples of that this morning. So there's a wide range of services that can be provided. In terms of some of these benefits, clearly again, ease of contact and accessibility. I mentioned the issue of the homework assignments earlier. For many individuals living in the internet age, the idea of immediate access is very important. And so things happening real time as opposed to waiting until my appointment next week. Whether the mental health professional is going to respond in real time is a whole other matter. One of the dilemmas that comes up is if a client or the consumer anticipates anytime they send an email or text message to their mental health professional, they're going to immediately receive a response. That places some burden on the mental health professional and might be unrealistic. Related to that might be a situation where a client types a very long and detailed message with 12 questions and sub-questions embedded in it and then expects a response right away. That might not be realistic. And we'll talk about some of the ethical issues and dilemmas later, and that example will be used. One good thing about email communications is that there really is a tangible record. That's a plus and a minus. We'll talk later about confidentiality issues as the potential dilemma or drawback, but with emails, you have a tangible record. The issue of misunderstandings or miscommunications might be reduced. You can take more time and think about what you want to say as opposed to speaking right off the cuff. It could be a more thoughtful approach as well. And in terms of supervision and consultation, the internet provides dramatic increases in access to experts. Professional association listservs are available, email lists where people can type in a question and, in a very short period of time, get 10 or more responses from experts around the world. To be able to have that kind of access for consultation when you're faced with a clinically challenging situation without the access to the internet likely wouldn't happen. You're pretty much then restricted just to people you know personally or who are in your local area. So it greatly expands the opportunities for consultation. And we mentioned overcoming barriers before. In terms of some of these benefits, again, the contact, ease, and accessibility, timeliness, there are some risks that come with this. I mentioned that if someone is anticipating an immediate response, you have to be able to provide that, and we'll talk about informed consent and that that's essential to make sure that the consumer of the service has a reasonable, realistic expectation. If you have 30 clients and each one emails you and expects a response in the next 5 minutes, that's likely not to happen, and so one would have to consider that. You'd also basically be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, I think access is really good. So, for example, I have my cell phone on me right now, and you know, it could go off at any second, and if it might be a client who has a question or a crisis or an issue. So having, or they might text me. That access is wonderful. At the same time, being accessible to them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week might not be so wonderful. And so we have to consider, how do we regulate that? And so we have to have realistic expectations about how we use technology in a clinical practice and ensure that our clients have realistic expectations. There are a number of legal issues. There are a number of studies that have been done that have looked at, do mental health professionals actually understand what are the ethics issues involved, what are the dilemmas they face, and are there any legal or regulatory issues relevant to providing online services? And we'll be talking about those. With informed consent, one interesting thing beyond just does the individual know what they're getting into is, do you even know the identity of the individual you're providing the service to? And minors who have their parents' credit card can log on, pay for services, fill out the paperwork, and receive mental health services. In most jurisdictions, what we have to consider legally, does an individual even have the right to consent to their health care, mental health treatment included? And so we have to have some mechanism for ensuring, number one, what the identity is of the individual we're meeting with and treating online, as well as the appropriateness of them accessing that service. And then with regard to the identity issue, what if it's a different person each time? You know, I could have who I think is one client, and then they could have someone else logging on the next time. And so there has to be some way of knowing the identity of the individual. And frequently uses of passwords for logging in are helpful. Obviously, if it's with a video component, it's much easier to know who the individual is. There are also some limitations to the services that we have to consider. And when a lot of the original research looking at e-therapy involving email communications showed a lot of promise for using the internet for providing services, again, for people who wouldn't have access otherwise, it's more cost effective, and even for follow-up for a variety of different kinds of both mental health and medical conditions and issues, that it's very helpful. At the same time, there are a number of risks, there are a number of limitations. You know, if I were to type an email to a client saying, how are you today? And the client's response were the letters F-I-N-E, the word fine. Well, reading that doesn't really tell me that much, because they could be saying fine, or they could be saying fine, or some other variation. There's a use of emoticons. People have a little smiley face after the word fine, or they can have it three exclamation points, or they can type it in all capital for effect. But again, there's a lot that can be lost just having internet as the means of providing the clinical service. Again, getting into video, it resolves a lot of that. In terms of the use of the internet, and some of my data is from the United States, and I'll also share some international data as well. In 2001, 56% of American adults reported having internet access. And certainly this is relevant in terms of, if you're going to provide a service, can people even utilize it? Will they have access? That increased to 73% of American adults in just a five-year period of time. And this data is already way out of date, and it's increased since then. So these numbers clearly continue to grow. 80% of all internet users have searched for healthcare information online. We had heard that earlier today as well. And 85% of undergraduate and graduate students own a computer, and 72% of them check their email at least once a day. And this is a cohort effect that we've heard about, and we're seeing how universal this is. And this is a cartoon. That's the problem with email, no one to bite. That it's pervasive, email's out there, but it changes how we communicate. It is sort of a whole new world in terms of how people communicate. In terms of cell phone use and text messaging, in December 2006, there were 18 billion text messages sent via cell phones each month. That's a large number. So this is numerous people using that. And that increased to 75 billion text messages each month in June 2008. And text messaging is reported available on 98% of all cell phones worldwide and don't require any special applications or downloads for use. So this is something that's widely accessible worldwide. This also has significant implications for issues in terms of disaster relief, responses to natural disasters, when the vast majority of people have cell phones and can be accessed. The whole accessibility issue becomes very important. And then in 2006, 30 countries had 100% per capita cell phone use, and two-thirds of cell phone users now report being active text messengers. So it highlights that this is a medium that is being very, very actively used, and one that we can tap into to provide services. And this is a cartoon at a funeral where they're saying, "We will now observe a moment of silently checking our BlackBerries." Again, highlighting how ubiquitous the use of these technologies are in many people's lives. And, you know, I remember the first time I was in an airport and I realized it seemed like I was the only person who wasn't either on a cell phone or a laptop in the entire airport. And I hadn't traveled in a while, and it was just amazing to me how, like, everyone is online. And not literally everyone, but clearly quite a large number. And this looks at internet use worldwide. And I'm not going to read the numbers to you, but you can get a sense, and this is in 2009, of the number of individuals in different geographic regions worldwide who use the internet. And it highlights, again, significant numbers. Then here on this next slide, we talk about the percent of each region's population that has internet access. So not just numbers, but now the percent of population. So with regard to being able to access individuals, here's who's using the internet. And again, I would highlight, all this is constantly increasing. These are not static numbers. And then this is changes in internet use by region. So, for example, while North America might have the largest numbers and the greatest percent, the greatest growth has been in the Middle East, followed by Africa. And so there are regions of the world where the growth of internet use is increasing exponentially. And again, these are ongoing trends. These numbers are just a snapshot of a moment in time. And because I made these slides, sent them in, and then, like, a week later went online to check and see, okay, have they changed? And so they're constantly growing. Some of the ethical and legal challenges of telehealth, I mentioned the issue of the identity of the consumer. Another one is assessing a client's treatment needs. What's the difference between an in-person assessment that one might do versus one that's done online? And can it be done just as effectively? Depending on the medium, the type of technology used, there can be differences in terms of both the effectiveness and the limitations of that service. And that I wouldn't want to present that any service can just be transferred or translated into an online medium or using technology. And so not every form of mental health service, for example, equally transfers into use of technology. And so that really needs to be fully understood and to be assessed. I mentioned the issue of informed consent briefly before. Basically, informed consent, the doctrine of informed consent addresses what would the average consumer of a particular service want or need to know so that they can make a thoughtful, informed decision of would I like to participate in this or not. So things might be cost. Does this cost anything? Or does the insurance cover it? Is it all covered? How is confidentiality handled? Is this all 100% confidential? Or are there any limits to confidentiality that exist? And this gets into legal issues. For example, in some jurisdictions, there are very specific limits to confidentiality, such as mandatory reporting requirements for suspected or observed abuse or neglect of a minor or vulnerable adults, or mandatory reporting requirements if a patient or client discloses a threat to do imminent lethal harm to an identifiable victim or a group of victims. And every jurisdiction has different laws, and each of us has to be aware of those. But if they exist, those are limits to confidentiality that I would think most consumers of our services would want to know prior to disclosing that information. And then, again, availability. How do they access us? How can they contact us between certain times, or is there a certain amount of time they have to wait for a response? Even emergency coverage arrangements that would be important. With regard to emergency situations and crises, I think this is perhaps one of the more important issues. When providing services online, one of the benefits is you can provide services to someone at a remote locale. They're not located right there with you physically, and that's great. So people who live in rural or remote areas get access to care. All the other types of people I mentioned before. But that's one of the limitations as well. How are emergency coverage arrangements made? How are crises handled? If I have a client who lives, 2,000 miles away that I'm providing an online mental health treatment to, how do I respond appropriately if that person becomes suicidal? Or what do I do if that person discloses that they're going to assault someone or kill someone, the next day or that evening? If I'm there physically in the same room providing in-person psychotherapy, it's much easier to address that. There's still significant clinical challenges, but my opportunity to intervene is much greater. And so there's a great need to make some kind of emergency service arrangements in the distant client's local area, and that we'd have to include that as part of our informed consent approach, as well as a basic arrangement before providing clinical services. I understand it depends on the nature of the services. If it's psychotherapy or counseling provided across distances, that might be different than, let's say, if it was career counseling, where the issue of depression or suicidality might not really be as relevant. But any client can become depressed or suicidal. Anyone could have an emergency or crisis, and we have to be prepared to address those. And if you're 3,000 miles away, that's a challenge. And so I would just mention that that's one of those issues we need to consider. And then licensing becomes a very big issue. In the United States, for example, one cannot practice psychology unless licensed in a particular state. There are some jurisdictions that around the world that don't have licensing, so it's maybe less of an issue. But one of the problems is if I'm living in Maryland, and that's where I practice, and I'm providing a service to someone in California, for example, I'm licensed in Maryland. Am I providing that service in Maryland, or am I providing that service in California? Because I am providing it in Maryland. That's where I am. But the client is receiving it in another state, and I might be violating that state's law by them receiving the service there. And then the issue is, do I have to be licensed in every jurisdiction where I provide a service? So that's a very big issue that needs to be worked out and addressed, and some states are, and some jurisdictions in general are making arrangements for that. In terms of ethics codes and what they say about telehealth, the American Psychological Association ethics code makes it very clear when they mention services provided via the internet and other electronic transmissions. So they make it very clear that the entire ethics code applies to all services, regardless of the setting, the context, or the medium that's used. And the Canadian Psych Association developed ethical guidelines for psychologists providing psychological services via electronic media. So they very specifically deal with that. The American Counseling Association has a similar set of guidelines, and the International Society for Mental Health Online also has suggested principles for online mental health services. And there's an e-health code of ethics. So clearly there's guidance available. These are some potential difficulties that one would have to address. And so I've mentioned earlier loss of visual cues. There's some technological challenges. One of the issues in most ethics codes is competence. And in addition to being clinically competent in the service we provide, we have to be technologically competent, that we have to actually have the mastery of the technology that we're using. And that becomes a big issue as well. There can be interruptions in the technology, and that can cause crises for clients, and we'd have to make advance arrangements for that. These other issues I've mentioned. These are some examples of the use of the internet, even outside of mental health, where there are studies that have been done that show its great value. So for home-based monitoring for insulin-dependent diabetes, the cost savings is tremendous, and compliance with follow-up and aftercare goes up dramatically. Telephone monitoring for cardiac rehabilitation patients, use of rehab psychology, telehospice, using the internet and telephone for hospice care. There's also the issue of peer-delivered support, not just by the professional information giving, which have been talked about earlier today, treatment with problem gamblers, interactive behavioral internet interventions of pediatric encopresis. I mean, this is just to give you an idea. There's a wide body of research literature for different populations of how the technology and the internet can be used for providing actual clinical services, and then for services provided in person for the follow-up and aftercare in terms of greater compliance with aftercare and greater outcomes. Another one is an online treatment program for panic disorder. Online assessments are very big and growing, and even for behavioral health care consultation, education, training, and supervision, as I mentioned. There's lots of potential. This is untapped. I think there's a lot that can be done. You know, in the APA ethics code, it mentioned the use of the internet and other media. The reason it says other media is because it's anticipating that there are new media that have yet to be developed or even invented or thought of yet that will be effective for providing mental health services. And so we haven't even thought of them yet, but obviously they'll be developed. And so clearly we need to understand, are these services equivalent to in-person services, or are they adjuncts to them? So, for example, is online counseling equivalent to in-person counseling? And so this is an area that needs to be studied. Interestingly, there are several studies that look at the therapeutic alliance that find that it's equivalent or even greater in terms of online treatments versus in-person, so that there's not a degradation of the therapeutic alliance that's seen. And so this is a promising area. Certainly, we have to address the clinical, ethical, and legal issues, and depending on one's jurisdiction, knowing the laws where you are practicing and knowing the laws where the recipients of the services are residing become very important. And we'll have to look at the issue of regulation and how this can open up if all jurisdictions have agreements to allow you, if you're licensed in one jurisdiction, you can provide the service in others rather than having to be licensed in every single jurisdiction. But clearly, in terms of the global community in which we live and function, the use of the internet is creating numerous opportunities, granting great access to care for many people, and it's very, you know, there's a lot of innovation, and maybe many of you in the room will be part of this movement of, you know, greater access to care and new innovative treatment models and approaches that don't even exist today. And apparently that's it. So thank you.